Okay, Ruby, why don't you tell me a little bit about your family background and how you got to Fort Peck in the first place? Where'd your family come from?
Oh, my parents came to Havre from Missouri shortly after the turn of the century. Dad moved out to Havre to homestead. He sent for Mother, and they were married in Havre. So we children grew up, there was five of us, and we grew up on a farm until we lost our mother. She died very young, and we moved into town. So we grew up, actually, most of our life was spent in Havre. We never went back to the farm after her death. But those few years we were out there, it was a very interesting life, to say the least. The prairies, the little teepee rings that were all over the place. We used them for playhouses. Oh. Now, if you go out there, everything is plowed under. It's in...
Okay, well, we were talking about Havre and the...
Oh, the early days in Havre.
Early days.
Okay.
How did the Depression affect your family?
Well, like most families in that area, there was absolutely no work for people. Dad had worked for the railroad a short time, and that job faded out. Dug coal for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Did a little of everything, except there was no one ever heard of relief. Nobody ever asked for relief. There wasn't any, and you either worked or you starved. And his primary purpose then was to raise the five children and try to feed them. I went into nurse's training after 2 years of high school. My older sister went to school and became a school teacher. And the other children were smaller, of course, and they were home there through those years. I finished nurse's training, got my RN in the spring of 1931.
Where did you go for that training?
I trained in Havre, Sacred Heart Hospital there, and worked little jobs. There were very few jobs for nurses, and if you were fortunate enough to get a bootlegger for a private duty case, you got paid. I still haven't been paid for some of the cases I had.
What do you mean if you got a bootlegger for...
The bootleggers had money. They were the only people in the community that had money.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I admired bootleggers, but after all, you had to make a living, and it was kind of nice to get someone who could pay you. I went to Great Falls and worked in the spring of 1933 for 1 month at the largest hospital in the state at that time, the Columbus Hospital. And for that, I worked 12-hour night duty for $30 a month, plus room and board. Now, if we could take off 2 hours to sleep, we worked 10 hours. So figure it out, it comes out to just about 10 cents an hour if you ever got that sleep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't stay there very long. I stayed down there about a month. Later, when I got my telegram, which I still have, offering a job at Fort Peck, and this was a temporary job, but it was such a thrill to get work that's actually going to have a paycheck with it.
Yes.
And so I came to work for the Corps of Engineers in October. Excuse me, it was November. We opened the hospital November 30th, so I probably went about the 1st of October because I was here approximately a month before the hospital opened. And they were corralling all the nurses in here. We had maybe, I think there was 8 or 10 of us, most of them from Montana. There was one nurse from Miles City, two from Butte, one from Great Falls, I was from Havre, one Manaconda, one from Minnesota, and one North Dakota. I think that takes care of the nursing staff at the Fort Peck Hospital. We all came in here. It was pretty cold out, and we were all housed in the hotel, in the women's wing, and we had three doctors and a dentist here, but the hospital was still under construction. So a truck picked us up at the front door here a bus or truck, I think it was a truck, and took us up to the barracks area where they had a station there where they did physicals for the coming incoming workers. And we worked up there rolling bandages or making finger sponges. In those days, you did your dressings by hand until we were bored to death with it. I remember those big baskets of dressings sitting around because they had us on the payroll, so they wanted us to work. We didn't wear uniforms there.
Goodbye,
sir. Have a good day.
And anyway, we were really excited when the hospital was finally completed and they told us we could move in. And it was exciting to move in the beds, get the things unpacked. We did a little bit of everything. We had plenty of male help to do the heavy lifting, but the nurses were setting up our equipment and getting everything ready for, and the place was so exciting. Wherever you went, there was so much activity. Dust, I remember dust everywhere. There was no trees in this town. Mm-hmm. There was no grass in this town. And we couldn't care less. We were working. We wore white uniforms. This was required and expected, which was fine. White uniforms, white shoes. And I remember going from the hotel over to the hospital and back. And especially that winter when it became very cold. Time or two, we talked the cooks in the kitchen to let us go out the back door. It was a little closer. We'd grab our lunch sack. We had a brown bag. Mm-hmm. And if that was on night shift mostly, the day nurses usually came back and ate here at the hotel. But when it was too cold, you just decided you're only going to make that trip one day, although it's only a few yards away.
Where was the hospital from here?
The hospital from here is, let me see, is that east? Southeast.
We're at the hotel. And it's not, in this compound here?
No, it's right across the street from the hotel, mm-hmm. southeast of the hotel, and just, I think it's due south of the administration mm-hmm. building. It is now an apartment building.
Oh, okay.
And, of course, it was run by the Corps of Engineers with all civilian doctors, civilian nurses. Even though it was under the Army, we were all civilians there. Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell me something about how the hospital was structured? Who were these doctors and the dentists that came in? Do you recall any of them?
I remember some of the doctors' names. I wish I could remember them all, though it was only three. Dr. Waldron was the medical officer in charge, and Dr. Mason. For some reason, I don't seem to remember the third doctor. Mm-hmm. And the dentist was Dr. Mitchell. Mm-hmm. Dr. Mitchell's office wasn't set up, wasn't quite finished as early as the rest of the place was. So we began immediately to fill the hospital up with workmen. They had to work for the Corps of Engineers to be in there. The many contractors' men, if they became ill, were taken into Glasgow, or they'd go over to the Smith Clinic here. The hospital had 22 beds. So for a project of this size, there was no way you could take care of the contractors' men. So the Smith, Dr. Smith, built a clinic out here. That is, he established a clinic out here with a doctor on duty out here at Fort Peck all the time. They could be taken care of either in the clinic or they would be taken into the Deaconess Hospital in Glasgow, the only hospital there, which is 20
Dr.
miles away.
Dr. Smith was really from Glasgow?
Yes, he lived in Glasgow. Dr. A.N. Smith, the senior Dr. Smith, was the founder of the Smith Clinic, and later on his son worked with him, Dr. Phil Smith. But this is a few years later that Dr. Phil got his MD and came back and worked with the clinic. But for many years later, Dr. Phil had a contract with the government here too, and long after our hospital closed, he came out once or twice a week and worked with us at the aid station, taking in anything that needed attention. But back to the early days, the hospital had, as we said, 22 beds. We got the first iron lung brought into the state of Montana, drinker respirator. Was never used, but as far as I know, but once. It might have been used more. We had no polio. We were afraid of this all the time at that time. We did have a man who was struck by lightning and had stopped breathing. And the iron lung, apparently, I don't recall too much about this, except that it did keep him breathing. Hmm. We had a modern operating room, and for emergencies. And of course, we would take in anyone who was injured on the job if it was a life and death matter. There's no problem there. But primarily, any of the elective surgery or any other illness that could be taken care of in the other hospital was taken in there. It was a much larger facility. Mm-hmm. After we were there a few weeks, I'm not just sure. I know the first night, I went on night duty the night they opened. I went on at 7 o'clock in the evening. And after work 7 to 7. For 6 weeks without a day off because we were still getting organized. I was a little anxious to get a day off because I wanted to get out and see the boomtowns. I wanted to see all of that. I was young enough to want to see some of the dives around. We called them nightclubs, but that's by courtesy. They were really something. And all of the teachers, nurses, the very nice gals of Fort Peck, did make the rounds and look at them. I can't say we all got drunk and carried on there, but it was an interesting, wild place, and it'd be a good idea to have a very good escort with you when you went. This was, and usually you'd make the rounds once you've done it, you wouldn't really care too much about going back. I'm trying to think anything more of the hospital right now.
Well, who was the doctor in charge of the hospital? Were these all young men?
Dr. George Waldron, I'm not sure how old he was now, I can't be sure, but I would say he was in his middle 20s. He and Dr. Mason and the two nurses came from Rochester, Minnesota. They came from the Mayo Clinic. Dr. George Waldron, can't remember Dr. Mason's first name, but, and the Rosalind Kunkel was the head nurse, and name escapes me right now.
So are you telling me that the chief physician and the head nurse came from the Mayo Clinic?
Yes.
So they had excellent credentials for
coming here. Yes. I have a feeling that I don't know for sure, but I have a feeling that that is why they were selected, because Montanans had preference. We may not have had anyone in Montana qualified. I'm just guessing, but I have an idea that they had the best credentials, and naturally they put the best people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why they were selected.
I'm sure they were.
Because there was a selection. There was people out of work everywhere. I'm sure there was doctors and nurses. There must have been a lot of applications in there.
Do you have any idea why you got the job here then?
Well, I think that there probably this was the thing. I got my application in. I had applied. I had applied back in. As soon as I wrote my civil service exam back, I think I wrote that in January or February 1934
mm-hmm.
in Haver at the federal building, hoping somewhere to get a job someplace. I didn't know it would be Fort Peck. We didn't know about this place at all at that time. And that was on file with the Civil Service Commission. So I was qualified, and probably I just my name turned up. If they're giving Montanans first choice,
mm-hmm.
that limits it down to a bit. And so I suppose that was why. I had a friend who wrote an examination the same time I did, and she was appointed about the same time I was to the U.S. Marine Hospital in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
Neither of us put our preference down. We would have gone anywhere for work.
Mm-hmm. How did you first hear about Fort Peck?
Rumors. There's something booming down at Glasgow. We didn't know what it was. I can't remember now how that happened, how I first heard about it. And it wasn't that they're building a big dam or a project. It was that there's going to be a lot of work there for the men. Our people from this part of the country were, just desperate. All the towns along the High Line were in dire straits for work. And my dream was somewhere along the line to get a civil service job. I did have an appointment at one time for 10 weeks at the Indian Hospital at Fort Belknap, and that opened my eyes to the possibilities of something with the federal. Seems like there was more money in the federal government than there was in the other hospitals. And that was my reason for wanting to go to work for the federal government.
How did you first hear about your appointment to this hospital, and what was your first reaction and impression?
Well, I have with me, and I put it on display over here, the telegram that I got. I was staying with a sister on the farm, helping her with her big family. They had a lot of food out there. They had a garden, and even though they were poor as everybody else, they still were, she needed help with the children.
Mm-hmm.
She'd had her babies pretty close together, and I was staying with her when another sister and boyfriend came out on the motorcycle. Later, that sister married that boy, and he's been my brother-in-law for over 50 years now. They came out on the motorcycle and brought me the telegram, because they knew it was important. And I almost could tell you from memory what the telegram said. It was telegraph, if interested in any way, in, if offered. They didn't offer me a job. If offered. And it mentioned a job at Fort Peck Hospital. Salary, $1,620 per annum, less 5% Economy Act, which brought it down to $1,500-something a year. Anyway, less $43 a month, subsistence and quarters. Anyway, it was the most fantastic telegram I'd had. Needless to say, I couldn't wait to get to town to fire back a telegram accepting. And I also have the letter confirming the job and notice to get a physical before I came, and that there were no family quarters available. If I had a family, I didn't have, but because I was single, I was only 22 at the time. And anyway, it was an exciting thing, and the main thing was I'm going to have a job after 3 years. I'd trained for 3 years. I'd been out of training, what, almost 3 years? 31, 32, 33, except for a few private duty cases and that little short time in the Indian hospital. So it was really wonderful. This was no dream of a career I was going into. This was only a temporary, and I knew that, but that was wonderful. Mm-hmm.
And that was a very good salary in those
days. It was an excellent salary. It was almost three times what I made in Great Falls.
What did you all do to celebrate?
Well, I really don't know of anything. I began to scramble around, try to figure out how to get the fare to get down to Glasgow. Ended up with a boyfriend driving me down here. And checked in at the personnel office, and then they signed me to quarters in the hotel. And everyone here in the hotel, I lived in the women's wing. The hotel's shaped like a large H, and one side of the H was for the women, single women. And everyone there was in the same boat I were. We had school teachers, telephone operators, some of the girls from the administration building, office workers. And there were no private rooms. You had a roommate, and you were assigned a roommate. If you didn't get along, you could exchange and all, but I was very fortunate. I had a delightful roommate. And in the early days, we were all in the same boat. We all came from no job to a job. And the entire hotel was an exciting place. The people who worked here, who lived here, had to have a certain income to live in the hotel. We were fortunate. We made much less than most of the people here because our doctor insisted the nurses had to live in the hotel. He wanted us close to the hospital. Otherwise, we might have lived in the women's dormitory, which was somewhere away. I'm not sure where that was now. It seems like it was up in the barracks section. There was another facility there for some of the women. And now I couldn't even tell you how many rooms there were, how many of us were here.
It was more expensive to live here than in the dormitory.
Yes, it was. It was more expensive, and we thought it was elegant. We thought this was, compared to the facilities around, we were very fortunate to have a wash bowl with hot and cold water in the room. We had a bath hall down the hall, had a row of showers. But this wasn't bad at all. That was great. And our meals, of course, prepared for us, everything provided. Transportation was something else, getting anywhere. There was a bus that rode into Glasgow. I don't remember how many times a day now, but if you happened to catch a school bus later on, a school bus would take you in if they had room on it, anything going in. And I remember a number of times people here in the hotel going into town, you'd ask anybody going to Glasgow, anyone was welcome if they happened to have a car. Very few people had cars. I went in one time. I wanted to go back to Havre to visit my family, and one of the men gave me a lift. I was talking to him in the dining room at the table, and his name was Doug Moore. He lived here in the hotel. He lost his life in the slide. They found his body over a week later floating in the lake. And I always think of that little ride into Glasgow and him giving me that lift, and the shock of the place after what had happened, and losing him. because he was very well liked by the people in the hotel.
Let's go back and talk about, you got a ride down here for the job. Mm-hmm. What was your first impression when you arrived here of this project? What was the line?
Beehive. Everywhere you looked. Vehicles, mostly trucks. Seemed to me they were running everywhere. And the excitement of the personnel office with so many people lined up for work. And they had come in every kind of a vehicle you could imagine. Some have ridden a freight train and thumbed their ride out here.
There was a very long line of men, young men.
Men and a few women, yes, and you waited. If you had an appointment, as I did, you didn't wait quite as long, but you still waited. And I just vaguely remember this. It's mm-hmm. kind of a... But the activity everywhere was sort of exciting because these little towns had been dead for so long, it was a little bit overpowering. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I remember that is ingrained in my memory, and that's walking down the main street of Fort Peck and looking at the license plates on the cars. Very few from Montana. Mm-hmm. Every state, it seemed to me, in the Union was down there. I think everybody had come to work here. There were a few from Montana.
Uh-huh. Why don't you tell me a little bit more about the hospital? What did they do for medical care before this hospital was set up?
Well, that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think possibly the doctors may have been here a little longer. They were here doing their physicals. They were giving inoculations, flu shots, I suppose, because we did have a lot of flu here. And the station at the barracks where the nurses went was pretty well established when I came, but it never occurred to me to ask what they did before that. We had a ambulance that the Smith Clinic had. Now, whether the Corps of Engineers had an ambulance at that time or not, I couldn't tell you. I don't remember that. We had one when I came, so probably they had one too. And so accidents on the job, which do happen at a place the size of this, were, I'm sure, taken care of. But just how it was done. Mm-hmm. The Smith Clinic, they had one or two doctors over there most of the time, and the doctors commuted back and forth from town. The Smith Clinic in town had several doctors, mm-hmm. too. And so they would work over at the clinic, and then, of course, the Glasgow doctors would work with them.
Where did your doctors live?
Our doctors lived in, the single doctors lived in the hotel. The married doctors, when their families were able to get their families, which took a little time, had houses in town. They lived in the temporary houses.
In Fort
Peck town site, yes. Mm-hmm. Most of them, the big dream was to get your furniture here. You're waiting for your stuff to come, waiting for your wife and kids to come, those that had mm-hmm. families. Some of the doctors were single, mm-hmm. and they lived right in the hotel.
Was there much turnover in medical staff while you were here? Or did the doctors tend to stay here?
I don't recall a big turnover, but I only worked here until the following summer. Let me see, just a minute. I have to think twice here before I answer all these. No, I worked here over a year, I guess, because I was married in October. And so I could only tell you that because from then on I had my own life.
Do you recall, you said you worked the first shift in the hospital. Mm-hmm. What was that first shift like? Did you have patients?
Well,
what happened?
We had a few. They weren't very sick. I don't think there was much to do right then. You answered the telephone. You took care of anything that happened, had to be done. Generally, there'd be medicines, a few medicines to give. Penicillin was in the future. We didn't have such a thing then, so I didn't give any of that right then. Later on, very shortly after that, we were really happy to get penicillin here because we had a terrible outbreak of pneumonia. And it was, but before we had the penicillin, there were other treatments used. We had at one time, I remember, 5 oxygen tents at one time with people in them. We lost a lot of people. I think if I remember correctly, I kept the names of the young men who died over there, and there was 19 of them on my list in about 2.5 months. They were between the ages of 19 and 25.
What did they die from?
Called it pneumonia. He didn't really know. here we have Rochester doctors with access to the most modern medical treatment we had then. The Corps of Engineers would have done anything for this. So we were not, they were given the best care one could get.
Mm-hmm.
They were in touch with, we'll say, Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just using that, but there was, certainly everybody cared. It became so serious that when we admitted a man with a cold, rang a temperature of 100, 101, we wired the relatives immediately, which normally you'd never do, because they didn't recover. Some of them didn't. We, of course, a number of them did recover. But they were so very, very sick. Why this is, to this day, I don't know. Some people seem to think it was the tunnels, the dust.
These were primarily tunnel workers?
Most of them were, but one of our nurses contracted pneumonia and was dead in 5 days. Young widow, had two little kids. So she never went near the tunnels, so I can't see why, you know, we don't know. Today, I don't know why we didn't. Now, pneumonia is not the terrible thing it was then. But anywhere at that time, not only in Fort Peck, but any time you diagnose pneumonia, it'd be very much like saying it's malignant.
Tell me about the nurse that died, one of your own.
I don't know much about her. I can't even remember her name now. She came here and was only with us a little over a month. She was a young widow, had two children that she'd left with her parents, and was living here in the hotel. And she knew she was dying toward the last, because she left her diamond tie-pin to the boy, her husband's diamond. Her husband had died a short while before, and her own diamond ring to the girl. Her name probably would be in the Anals, you know, records, but I can't remember her name now because she was here such a short time.
What impact did that have on the rest of the medical staff?
It was terrible. Our morale was pretty low already. And I was, I remember the morning, the day that she died, we came on duty. We worked terribly long hours. 12 and 14 hours was not at all unusual. And it seemed like there was so much to do and so little time to do it and so many more coming in ill. And when I came on duty, with a group of us came in, the day shift came in at 7 in the morning, the night nurse was sitting at the desk crying. And we looked up and we said, how is she? How's whatever her name is? She said, look at her. She was going. And I don't know why. And I'm thinking of the other, well, I said 19 young men because I kept those names for years. I don't have them now. And what a terrible thing this was for their families. Come out here to work like they did and not die on some big, terrible accident, but a sickness that would... So it was a job round the clock, taking their temperatures, trying to do what we could. They used a serum. I remember we gave them some kind of a serum that would shoot their temperatures up very high. If the temperature was like 101 or 102, we'd shoot that temperature up to 105 to make the body react and fight that in order to bring out the antibodies or whatever. This was just I think it was pretty much of a experiment. It didn't hurt them, apparently. Some of them seemed to recover, so they had to do what they could.
Mm-hmm.
I think we gave them milk, if I remember right, intramuscular milk, which would really... That is kind of a vague memory, though. It's funny why I can't remember all that now.
This was all during the first winter.
This would all be during the first, probably, winter of 34 and 35,
So it was your first months of operation.
The first months, yes.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I left there in the spring of 36. Well, partly 36, the winter, January 36 on that winter, 35 and 36.
Did you see this high number of pneumonia cases during the next winter as well? Was it partly seasonal, and did this continue, or was this something that happened during that winter in particular?
I think we had the peak of the problem. I think somehow it seemed to taper off. But I left there in, I think it was March of 1936. So from then on, I was out of contact with the hospital. By that time, in the meantime, I had gotten married. I was expecting, and my first baby was due in August. So from then on, I had another life completely. I was cut off. We did have, I know we had a shower for one of the nurses who got married, had it in my little house in Wheeler. And the girls made a double shower and brought me one, too, for my new baby, which was kind of fun. There was a very good, I thought, feeling between the nurses. We all had a real good rapport. And, of course, it was all kind of, well, the excitement of living in a boom town at that time. I used to sneak in here and have a shower once in a while in the quarters here where I lived, as my husband did at the barracks where he had been, because we didn't have the facilities in Wheeler.
That you had here.
Mm-mm. Mm-hmm. And that was another story, another life.
So when these young men would come in and they would be so sick, when someone died, what did you do?
Well, you, of course, you'd notice.
That's so sad. Tears in my eyes. So the first ones you didn't know they were, you didn't expect them to die, so you didn't notify relatives.
Well, no.
But you thought they'd recover, young, healthy.
Well, big, strapping, husky young men who had passed their physical to work here, and then to come in with a cold or flu, feeling miserable, probably a few chills. And in maybe 3 days, they were gone. You didn't have time. You hardly had time to diagnose and treat them properly. There was no time. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, you'd be doing all lab tests. We had a laboratory over there, and we did whatever tests were done in those days, the blood test, the urine test, and all. But nothing like the equipment you'd have now. There was, I believe myself, that everything possible was done that could have been done. But this doesn't, well, it doesn't remove the memory and the tragedy and the horrible feeling that we're just not doing enough.
Mm-hmm. Those people that you did notify, their family, did their families come?
A few of them did. Some of them came. I don't remember too much about that at all. I don't. Mm-hmm. Some of them did, if they were in the area, and most of these young men came from this area. They didn't all, though. We had a few from distant. We had a few letters from their people later thanking us for what we had tried to do. Mm-hmm. But as far as remembering, I don't remember that much of where they all came from, but they weren't necessarily off Montana.
What did you do with, when people died here, what happened to them? Did you perform autopsies here?
There was a little morgue where the body was placed until it could be taken by an undertaker and shipped to wherever the family lived or where they requested.
There was a morgue in the
Yes, we had a little,
part of the hospital?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was a very small room. Mm-hmm. Put maybe two bodies in there. I don't remember ever having two in there one time. They were taken out as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. In fact, the hospital was very small. There wasn't room for anything. The wards, we had very few private rooms. So they were, I forgot to bring that. I have a picture of me standing at the end of a ward with all these beds on both sides.
Well, I'd love to see it. How was it laid out then?
Let's see, I said there was 22 beds, didn't I? I can't remember now how the ward was divided in, must have been a line down the center and probably about, I would say 6 beds on either side. That would make about maybe 24 beds in the room because you'd have the center section. Isn't that strange that I don't remember that much about it? I know a lot of beds in there. And probably maybe as many as 4 rooms.
Were they set up to handle different kinds of problems?
They were, well, you tried your best. If you had to isolate, we tried to isolate the pneumonias if possible, especially when we began losing them. That was not possible always. Mm-hmm. We had a very stern, strict hand-washing technique where you had to try, because after all, we don't know what we have here. And then, of course, we also had a number of accidents on the project where they had to be brought in there. Mm-hmm. And, whatever was necessary was done.
What did you tell me about those accidents?
Well, I remember mostly of when I was on night duty. We took turns taking night shift. And when you're on night shift, you're alone. over there. There's nobody else on duty. You can call the doctor, you can call someone, but there was no operator over there in the daytime. They'd have a receptionist who took care of those calls. So we had a job of sending the ambulance out to these places. And I just happen to remember one night of telling us that to get the ambulance over here. And I got in the habit of writing the time. We had a pad there by the phone. You'd write the time that you received the call and the time you sent the ambulance and where, because this was a big place. And so, for example, if they'd say on the upper toe where they're dumping that gravel, I'd write that out because I had no idea. They'd know, the ambulance driver knew. And so they would handle this. Maybe 5 minutes later, you'd get another call. Where in the so-and-so is that ambulance? We've been waiting here for a half hour and they haven't come. They're desperate over there. I'd have the time down. It hadn't been 4 minutes yet.
Mm-hmm.
We were very careful. Were so upset, those men over there, because they had something they needed help for. Somehow, I just don't like to go into the accidents. I could, I suppose, but...
You're the only one that can really tell that for the historical record.
Should that be in there, do
yes,
you think?
I think it should be.
Well, I don't... There's one man... I'm not sure I can get him in any kind of chronological order, because they're kind of a jumble in my memory.
Mm-hmm.
One night in particular, we had a call, and they said there was a man injured. I think a train had run over him. And the ambulance left. The operator on duty over at Bell Telephone Company, who happened to be a lady, she was married to this workman, took the call. And when I said we always ask certain questions. Where is it? What's his name? And then who's he work for? Usually, they wanted a lot more information. But I learned the hard way. I learned from our medical officer in charge to get the ambulance on its way and tell him to call me back and give me this other. I had a page to fill out. I didn't want to sit there answering questions before it left. So we'd give the name. And who he's for, it helps to know who the boss is, whether they're working for Mason and Walsh, Fielding and Shepley, the Corps of Engineers, who it is. Because you had a project that was so large that it'd be a terrible thing to have the driver looking for and not knowing where the injured man is.
Mm-hmm.
But this man had, anyway, the lady at the telephone over there, office, screamed into the telephone, "That's my husband," and dropped the receiver and left and came over. And she was there before he got there. He had had his leg cut off, and he didn't live. He was still living. They brought him in there, but it was.
He died from losing blood.
Yes. Yeah, probably. Very likely died of shock from it. I can't remember his name, but I remember that awful thing because I'd been rooming with a telephone operator, and it was her friend who had. How they handled the switchboard over there, I don't know. But when she left the switchboard and just, she must have gotten somebody to take over because she was over at the hospital before the ambulance got back. Another accident.
How did you handle her? I mean, you're on the staff here and you're about it, right?
Well, that was about it, yes.
And in comes this...
Well, I was waiting with her. I was waiting with her before. And so I tried to keep her out. So we could, well, there was not much room in there, and you have to, and I talked to her while they were waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they brought him in, got him on the examining table, and the doctors, everybody was working over him. I don't know what they did. I imagine they started IVs and did whatever you do in an emergency like that. And she stayed back out of the way. I think she knew it was pretty serious because the call sounded that way, and she'd heard it. Another time we had, where they were dumping gravel, they covered a man with this heavy rock, this gravel. I don't think he knew what hit him. But I think it must have broken every bone in his body. I remember helping getting ready for the undertaker and lifting his arm. It was like lifting a stocking. The arm just limp. I was horrified at a few of them. So they did. I think the accidents, the total number was probably very, very small considering the magnitude of the job.
Mm-hmm.
The safety factor here, the Corps of Engineers was very stern and very strict about safety. And a man could be fired for violating safety rules.
Were they?
They were. You bet they were. You wore certain parts of the job, you wore a helmet.
Mm-hmm.
you wore a tin helmet. You were caught on there, out there in this area without your helmet. You could be dismissed. And you wore safety toe shoes in certain areas. Where they worked down along the floats and the docks, they wore a floating vest. If they didn't wear a vest, they'd certainly be reprimanded at least. Mm-hmm. And most of them were very, very willing to cooperate. You didn't, a few of these stories, and some of the stories were pretty much told around the project and were exaggerated, taught them that these rules are for their own good. Awards were given for a certain section that had no accidents within a certain time, and then lost time accidents, I remember. If a certain group, we'll say the dredging crew, had a lost time accident, or had no lost time accidents, after losing men from the job where they had to take time off, they carried a little flag, they carried a banner that they'd fly. And so you had a very active safety section. And these safety engineers were everywhere. And every one of us were instructed, if you saw one thing anywhere on the project that would be a hazard, if it's something someone might stumble over, you reported it immediately. So this was one of the big things, and they did make every effort to cut accidents to a minimum.
Were there other accidents, minor accidents?
There were a good many minor accidents. Right now, I didn't handle them very much. The ones I took care of would be admitted into the hospital or when I was alone on duty. Those I would remember, but the others I would be busy. Well,
minor accidents might come through.
Let me see if I can think of any right offhand. Old man hit his hand with a hammer. Had to come in, be taken care of, whether x-ray it, is any broken bones, take care of it. Whether or not he'd be put on paid sick leave or not. Generally he was. If he was hurt on the job, he was definitely had sick leave coming.
What was sick leave?
Sick leave means he's paid. He's paid for his job, even though he's not working. And this, again, they're trying their best to keep that down to a minimum.
This is maybe a good time to talk about, you talked about the aid station. Could you talk about that? What was that, how that functioned?
Oh, that happened years later. Now, I'm talking about earlier, 1934, 35, 36. What year the hospital closed, I don't know, because I moved away in 1940 and went out to Bonneville. My husband was transferred there. And I had two sons by then and was not working.
Mm-hmm. But I thought you'd refer
so when
to
I came back,
first
we,
aid station. Or
yes. When I moved back, we moved back in 1943 mm-hmm. when my husband went to work at the power plant. The powerhouse opened in 43, the first powerhouse. And after that, I was appointed again to a job over at the first aid station. The hospital had closed. The job had been completed. People had moved away. That was a small maintenance crew left in town. We didn't have the big construction work we had had in the past. It's all finished now. So this has come down to a small community. So our job was quite different. We still did physicals. We had a contract with a doctor from, we had no doctor here, no government doctor. A doctor from the Smith Clinic came out and with a, he held office hours a couple times a week. In the meantime, we had an ambulance. The old ambulance was still here, the Corps of Engineer ambulance we could use, we needed. And any time that ambulance was used for anything, one of the nurses always went on it. We had no EMT teams in those days. Mm-hmm. And Emmy White, who had been head nurse at the hospital, was in charge of the first aid station. And she was the only nurse over there for some time, I'm not sure, several months, maybe a year or two, I'm not sure the time. And she asked for an assistant. I worked over there while she was on her leave, and then later I went on. It was a temporary appointment, but it was a pretty much part-time job, but it ended up being full-time because we took turns, worked around the clock. We were always one or the other on call. And the first aid station had what was left of the laboratory. We had a small laboratory. We could do simple blood tests, urine tests. We had a nice x-ray machine that had been from the hospital. I didn't do x-rays. Emmy did the x-rays. She knew about that. But anyway, the school, we took care of the school children and the school kids that would get sick, they'd send them down the street. The aid station was right over where the school is now, facing this building here. It's right, that building, the blue doors was our, and it was in a part of what had been the old soils laboratory. The laboratory was still there and the Bureau of Reclamation people were in there. And of course, we were under the Corps of Engineers yet. but they occupied the same building. Another little thing I might mention here in conjunction with this, the Corps of Engineers and Bureau of Reclamation, it's been well known for years, have had a, competition. They don't always get along. And one of the articles I read about them that points this out in the best way, and that is in their attempt to get money from Congress.
Just a second.
I think the problem was there that sometimes they would want to do the same thing, and if we didn't watch them, there'd be two dams going along side by side. Stretching it a little bit,
yeah.
But there'd be two projects, be doing the same thing. And since one was under the Bureau of Reclamation, which came under a different department, the Corps of Engineers was under the War Department, or Department of the Army, we called it at that time. The Bureau of Reclamation was under Department of the Interior. Mm-hmm. And these departments have their secretaries, separate heads. So you can't have two heads on a thing. So it did become a quite a thing. We noticed it here. I noticed. Everybody was aware of the fact that so-and-so from the Bureau, we always call the Bureau, the Corps of Engineers, didn't see eye to eye on a number of things. And yet we're all housed here together.
Mm-hmm.
So if you remember from history, General Pick, who wanted, he was over our project, he was from Omaha, and a man by the name of Mr. Sloan with the Bureau of Reclamation met, and they formed the Pick-Sloan Plan, which means the plan that builds the dams along the river. In one of the articles I read, it called it a nameless, shameless shotgun wedding. I'm quoting somebody else, that probably shouldn't be in there because it came out, I think it's a post or something, but you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
We got into just a little of this, not too much, because we took care of the Bureau of people, same as we did Corps of Engineers. As far as the nurses are concerned, it made no difference to us. But I went to a meeting one time, which was very interesting, over at the theater here. We had five governors. We had people from both the Corps and the Bureau describing their plans for what they're doing. And those men totally ignored each other. It was terrible. The town watched them. We were shocked, us little people sitting there watching these men on the stage there with their big map and their pointers of being so rude. This later was changed, but at that time it was something you couldn't help but be aware of.
How did it affect your work or the work of the community?
Not too much. I can't say that it made a big difference. The small fry, the little people, little unimportant people as we were, it didn't affect us much. I think it was between our bureaucrats. But after this, there was also a time when school teachers had a time getting a place to live here. For example, they weren't employed by the Army, they were employed by the federal government at first, and so it was only at the, you might say, the whim of the local authorities whether they'd have housing or not. And when they talked to them about this and how they're going to get funding for schools for these many children, because several hundred children here, they said, we're not here to build a school, we're here to build a dam. That's your problem. And so there was no money anywhere. It ended up with the Recreation Association here, which ran the theater. The theater ran around the clock. There seemed to be some pretty good funds in there, apparently. Took over the school, paid the teachers.
Really? Huh. And that, in some ways, was the community organization, is that what you're telling me?
This was the only equivalent
of a community council or anything.
And this went on for quite some time until, I wish I could remember the years.
That's very interesting. This was going on while you were here.
This is when I was living here with my husband and my family. The chairman of our school board, we had a local school board, went back to Washington to see what they could do about this because there was no, we couldn't resolve it. The state of Montana didn't want to take it over. We had no taxes here. There's no local taxes. We don't own our homes. There's no money here to run a school. So it took a special act of Congress, and I don't remember now that number, that bill, but it took care of the schools on these projects, not only ours but others, but it was done through the Fort Peck school board. Don Bentley was chairman of the school board at that time. Later, Valley County had tried to, it's for some time in here, had tried to do this. They had tried to come in and take over, but what they wanted to do was tax the personal property of people in the project. there's a big argument about this. People living in Fort Peck didn't feel that Valley County should come in here and do this. Valley County felt they should, so there's a big lawsuit over that for years. Finally, I think they threw their hands up out here and said, okay, take over. And Valley County had no money to pay the teachers. They got the job, but there was, when they went to taxes, I think my taxes came to $7.50 for that year because we had very little property. We didn't own anything. And so how are they going to run their school? So it took an act of Congress to get some funds to keep the school going. Mm-hmm. And the teachers were still locally employed. They weren't through the government system. It was a totally separate system.
Extremely interesting. Mm-hmm.
We had a postmaster here. He was on the Postal Service. That was a separate thing, too. Mm-hmm. And I remember sometimes the postmaster, post office people wondered about housing. They had quite a little time getting a place to live. You didn't just come in here and not, because you see, you don't have everything. Anyway, you can see where the Army's main problem was build the dam. They had their hands full. They couldn't be bothered with something like several hundred kids to be educated.
And all these families that they hadn't planned for to come. Mm-hmm. Oh. Well, why don't you tell me something about that? When you, what was the social life like here for a young single teacher when you first arrived? What did you work 12 hours, you said, 14 hours a day mm-hmm. sometimes, but you wanted to go out and see
you mean
all
the nurses,
the
you
guys.
Mean?
Yeah.
You said teacher is what I wanted. Well, there...
Did you go out to the bars?
Oh, yes. I don't remember going more than two or three times, uh-huh. probably the whole time I was here. But we did go because it'd be a group of something to do. I remember one time we went into one bar there near Glasgow, I think it was the Red Rooster, and there was a bunch of around-the-world Russian flyers in there. It was kind of interesting to see these Russians in there. It was kind of interesting up here. I just vaguely remember that. The first time I ever went out to one of these rounds, and it was always with a group. You had a carload. I had a very nice young man who was my escort. Remember, Sweet Olson, I have no idea where he, whatever he came, I've never saw him since. But I remember what a nice guy he was and what a nice bunch of people we had there. And yet it was such a wild place that you'd think, well, who'd go? We all looked a little embarrassed to even go into such a place because it looked like it had. But we stopped in at Wheeler Inn. I'd heard so much about Wheeler Inn, which maybe you've heard of.
No, what did you hear?
Well, Wheeler Inn was the biggest and the oldest of the nightclubs. Ruby Smith ran Wheeler Inn, and she had been in the Yukon and had had a very dubious reputation of running a bar and a dance hall there. She had the taxi dancers who were a dime a dance girls. And the name, the place, her club was called Wheeler Inn, and you'd spell it W-H-E-E-L-E-R hyphen I-N-N. Wheeler Inn, wheel your car on in to this place. And so when we got there, it was a very small room by our standards today, certainly. Low ceilings, heavy smoke, smelled of old stale beer, and just more people than you can crowd in. In the back of the room, it was against the law at that time to sell liquor over the bar in Montana, but they said you could get in there. As Ernie Pyle wrote in his little note, Ernie Pyle was here during that time, you could order this stuff all night. There's nobody to enforce that law. Mm-hmm. And so that night, I looked, and all of a sudden, somebody hit someone else, and I looked, and my goodness, there's a fight going on. And we kind of backed off and watched it, and then a little later, I don't remember now what the outcome of the fight was, just a couple men cutting up, they're probably drunk. And then later, after we left there, someone told me there had been a raid on the back room where they were selling liquor and gambling. And I was just thrilled to death. I'd always wanted to see a brawl. I'd always wanted to see a bar fight. And I didn't get to see the raid, but I was there. I was there when it happened. That's right when we were in the next room. So it was kind of silly, but we were young and we were anxious. It was kind of like the Wild West we'd read and heard about.
Another one of those functions that the Corps didn't have time to deal with?
This is on the outside of the project. This is,
oh
yes, the government town was fenced in. We called it the reservation.
It
was reserved for this project. And so they had no control over the boom towns or the life of the people outside. And so there was really no real law there. Mm-hmm. There was no way. The little town marshal couldn't possibly cover everything. The state, I think he was a state employee, mm-hmm. couldn't begin to, and so there was a lot of actual crime going on. It was a lawless place, as you have in many boom towns. We went into another place, another night spot. I wish I could remember the names of all those funny little places we stopped at, but there was the Red Rooster and the Wheeler Inn and the Buckhorn and typical Western names, and each one very much alike. Quite a number of them down below the river at Park Grove. I never went to any of them, but these were on the highway toward Glasgow. Mm-hmm. And one of the, we had our car, I remember having it just full of young people. You had to sit on somebody's lap, it was so crowded. And one young couple who had been married a short while were a lot of fun. And this young man, the married man, had gotten a little too much to drink. Most of the fellows didn't get drunk. They drink a little bit, but there's no real drinking, heavy drink, at least. But he had a little more than he should have. And so our young other, the single girl's boyfriends, had to kind of help look after his wife, because you'd have so many young men, you know, trying to, just be a nuisance in there. But anyway, we got out of the car, and this young married man took his hat. Somebody sat on his hat. Everybody, men all wore hats then. And it was absolutely crushed. So he took that hat in his fingers, held it up, and said, "I'm going to put syrup on that and eat it in the morning." This was as bad as anything got. I mean, the hilarity was, there was something every minute. Mm-hmm. One of the boys in our group was from my hometown. I'd gone to high school with him, and he didn't have a date. He was engaged to a girl in Harvard, and he wouldn't go out with anyone else. But he got drunk. The minute he was, had a little problem there. And so when we'd get to one of these dance halls, he would do a little dance with each one of the women in the party, do his little duty, and go back, put his head down on the table, and go sound asleep. So I said to the fellows, I said, "What's the matter with him? He sure doesn't look like he's having any fun." And they said, "He's having a great time. Look at him." That's just another silly part of the...
Did you dress up to go to these events? Or these?
Oh, yes.
What'd you wear?
You wore a long dress. And heels, earrings, the works.
Mm-hmm. Did men dress up to go to these parties?
Suits. A little bit. You didn't dress as casually as you do today. Now today, we'd probably wear jeans or... No, you didn't dress like that then. But the hats I mentioned, I can't remember a man showing up without some kind of a hat on. He might wear a cap, but they all wore... probably a dress hat.
What kind of music or entertainment was there at these night spots?
Pretty much music of the 30s.
Live music?
Oh, yes. I don't think any place didn't have live music of some kind. It was loud. It was probably not as loud as kids have today. But they all had live music, I'm sure.
What about these women that were there, the taxi dancers? Did you know any of the women who worked in these establishments?
No, I didn't. But I know at the time, I had the impression, and I was probably wrong, that they were all prostitutes. I thought they were terrible people. And reading now some of these things that some of the later men have written in our little book here for this Fort Peck reunion, some of the young men that danced with them and the way they spoke of them, those girls were simply out there. Some of them were very nice people. And we were young enough and ignorant enough and knew very little about that kind of life that we looked at them like, oh, they're something else, you know. And I think now we could have been very, very wrong. They're hungry. Those girls need a job, too. And if they can get a dime a dance, they're making a living, the only thing they knew. And I'm sure there was a number of prostitutes, too, that there were women, that what they call women of easy virtue, who follow the projects. And so we probably classed them all in the same category, which might not have been fair. I think as I'm older, I'm a little more maybe tolerant, if you want to say it. I don't think I'd be quite so quick to judge as I might have been then.
Were you...
Ruby Smith was well known. She was interviewed on the March of Time, which was an old radio program. And at that time, I remember hearing her on this March of Time, which was a national thing. And they, the remarks she made, she sounded very much like Mae West on there. She said, "Oh, we managed to make more money off of the boys of the WPA here than we did on the Yukon." I'd forgotten exactly, but I heard this on the radio myself. And my name happens to be Ruby. So when I got letters from my in-laws out on the coast, they said, "Well, we found out what you're out there for. We found out what you're doing. We heard you on the radio the other night," which was just...
But you were from a very respectable background.
Oh, yes.
And here
small
this was
town.
The 30s, and still Prohibition was essentially on.
Absolutely.
Here's this outlaw community, illegal activity. You assume prostitution's going on in these places. What did you think about when you went into these places? And was that an okay thing to do for a respectable
family? Not exactly. It really wasn't. Because when you'd meet someone who was room down the hall from you, a very nice little school teacher, or one of the other girls, these are all nice girls, and you'd look at them and you'd say, uh-oh, what are you doing here? We kidded each other about it. I think it was experiment, maybe. We wanted to see if it was as bad as we heard.
What had you heard?
Well, we had just heard that it was a wild, wild place where all the wicked people meet. We wanted to see it for ourselves. It was live.
Mm-hmm.
Wild West alive, I guess.
What did you think when Margaret Bourke White's piece was published in Life magazine later and talked about how
mm-hmm.
wild it was?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was a little disappointed because Margaret Bourke White stayed here at the hotel, and by that time I was having my first child, so I wasn't living here.
Mm-hmm.
But she... they did, I thought, featured the seamy side of the place. I think they could have used a little more of the engineering. But it might have been a good idea, too. Eleanor Roosevelt was very interested, very concerned and about the way the people live, the little shacks, the fact there's no housing. This might have been something they'd be interested in, beyond what the Corps of Engineers only doing what they were authorized to do. They couldn't go down and find a house for everybody that came in here.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of these boom towns, and I think there was at least 14 of them, well, the public health problem.
I want to talk about that, and this tape's about out, so let's put it...